all, we have today with us the Antigo High School as part of a Co-op class program. Would the students from Antigo please stand? Well, thank you. Won't you be seated, please? And we have students from Augusta High School. Would they stand, please? A welcome to you also. Please be seated. The students are here today with the Courtland Class program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar, and it has won two national awards for its outreach program. The students have been given synopses of the case that they are about to hear, and we hope that they enjoy, that's the appropriate verb, the proceedings today. Now that the students have been introduced to you all and us, I'd like to introduce the court. On my left, extreme left, is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his right is Justice Janine Geske. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right is Justice John Wilcox. And to Justice Wilcox's right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The students here today, as well as anyone else who wishes to participate, will meet with Justice Geske at noon, and they will be joined by perhaps other students. With that, we shall proceed to the case, which is 96-3281, Scott Anderson versus Circuit Court for Milwaukee County. Representing the respondent petitioners is Attorney Thomas Cannon. Mr. Cannon.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Attorney Tom Cannon from Milwaukee. It's my privilege to represent Judge Robert Crawford in Branch 10 of the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. Seated to my left is Attorney Scott Anderson, a distinguished member of the Milwaukee Bar, who is the appellant in this matter. The question presented by this case is one of great importance to the trial judges of Wisconsin. That is, do Wisconsin's judges have an effective sanction remedy available to them to help them manage their courts efficiently and economically? The facts of this case are simple and largely undisputed. The trial court issued a scheduling order scheduling a jury trial in a misdemeanor matter for 8:30 a.m. on November 5th, 1996. I invite the court's attention to that scheduling order, which is item number 7 in the record. Unfortunately, it is not in the appendix, but I would like to quote two things from the scheduling order because it does bear on an issue raised by Mr. Anderson, namely whether he had constitutional notice that he was facing sanctions in this case. Paragraph 7 of the scheduling order says, quote, "All attorneys and parties are to appear timely at the scheduled time for each court appearance." And that's right under the date that the case was set for trial at 8:30 on November 5th. And then the next sentence says in bold, "Sanctions. Unless good cause is shown for failure to comply, the court may impose appropriate sanctions." That's signed by Judge Crawford, and underneath, it says copy received in red, and the first signature is Mr. Anderson's signature.
Is this a pro forma a scheduling order, one that we would see in most courts in Milwaukee, or is this specially drawn up by Judge Crawford?
No, it's used by most of the misdemeanor judges. There are 11 in Milwaukee County.
What does timely mean?
Well, timely would mean on time.
This court timely today?
In my experience, Your Honor, timely means something different for judges than it does for lawyers.
You're right.
Unfortunately.
Should it? I know it does
probably,
as a practical matter, but should it?
It probably shouldn't.
Shouldn't, okay.
It probably shouldn't.
So what does an attorney do when the judge is late?
Other than wait. That's it. He waits.
Okay.
Mark him unqualified next time he runs.
Pardon?
Mark him unqualified next time the judge runs.
Possibly. Despite the warning in the scheduling order, Attorney Anderson did show up at 8:38 on the day in question, 8 minutes late. Judge Crawford gave Mr. Anderson the opportunity to be heard concerning his tardiness. The court asked Mr. Anderson why he was late. Mr. Anderson said, "I have no reasonable excuse, Judge." And the court then imposed a fine of $50. Now, the trial court had three options here. It could have proceeded under its inherent power to sanction Mr. Anderson. Secondly, it could have proceeded under the statutory power to sanction Mr. Anderson. Or thirdly, it could have proceeded under the contempt power to sanction Mr. Anderson. Judge Crawford specifically stated that he was not finding Mr. Anderson in contempt and was not proceeding under the contempt statutes. The court based its sanction on the inherent power, and there are two inherent powers that are implicated by this case. The first is the inherent power to discipline, sanction, and regulate lawyers. This is an inherent power of the judicial branch because, as this court stated in the Cannon case, because attorneys at law are officers of the court, judges have the power to sanction and discipline lawyers.
What judges? Trial judges, court of appeal judges, or only this court? As I read those cases, it would indicate that this court has the power to discipline.
I think that trial judges, obviously this court only has the power to disbar a lawyer or suspend a lawyer from practice, but there are other sanctions that are necessary to the efficient operation of a court that a trial judge has the right to impose.
So it's a very limited disciplinary.
I would say it is very limited disciplinary, and just probably for the purpose of maintaining the decorum and efficiency of the court. But there is a second, broader, if you will, inherent power, which this court discussed in the Latham case, and that is the inherent power to control disposition of causes on the court's docket with economy of time and effort. This court has repeatedly said that the inherent power to sanction is independent of the contempt power. It's also independent of the statutory sanctions power. Sanctions are reviewable only for abuse of discretion, which I think is a key factor here because one might ask the question, well, if the judge is proceeding under inherent power, what restrictions or limits are there? And abuse of discretion is the limit that is imposed on trial judges.
Well, where's the record here then to review? I mean, all the judge says is you're 8 minutes late and that interferes with my efficiency. How do we know that?
Well, the trial court did say that it was trying to try two cases that day, and we've cited some statistics that we've asked the court to take judicial review of in our reply brief, talking about the thousands of misdemeanor cases, roughly, I think, some 60,000 misdemeanor cases that come through the Milwaukee County misdemeanor branch each year, approximately 35,000 pending at any time, about almost 300 jury trials.
So how long did the second case take?
Pardon?
How long did the second case on his calendar take? We don't know that, do we?
We don't know that.
Okay. It may have folded.
It's possible, except that, of course, there are a number of cases that are scheduled each day, so that...
He said he had two.
He said he wanted to try two cases. And what he means by that, just so it's clear for the court, Judge Crawford believes that if he can start a misdemeanor case at 8:30 in the morning, and most
counsel,
of...
So is that in the record?
It's not in the record. But it would be
this is an abuse of discretion case. We have to have a record, don't we, to determine if it's discretion abuse?
Yes, you do.
We don't have the record.
That's not in the record.
Okay.
Counsel, would it have made really any difference as far as the judge's schedule? Let's just change the facts. It wasn't 8 minutes, but it was 80 minutes. If we're looking at the reasonableness, what the judge did under those circumstances, do you think it would be reasonable for the judge to say that I have this schedule, or can he just say that you're late for this particular proceeding and therefore you have upset my schedule? Does it make any difference if there were 8 trials later on that day from a reasonable standpoint?
I don't think that it does. And in fact, I've argued in our brief that I think it's somewhat akin to this court's rule against citing unpublished Court of Appeals decisions. My understanding is it's an automatic fine, and there's no hearing, there's no opportunity to be heard or to explain why a lawyer might have done that. No showing is required that it impaired or confused the court. It's simply automatic. And I think that when a busy trial court is dealing with a lot of cases and is trying to get through a calendar and sets a time and says you're going to be sanctioned if you're not timely, that showing up late is without an excuse.
What about 1 minute?
Well, I've cited a case in our brief in which a federal judge in Milwaukee held a lawyer in contempt and fined him $50 for 1 minute.
Oh, held him in contempt, not inherent power.
Well, I believe it was held in contempt for 1 minute.
What about 2 minutes? And how much? $5?
I mean, it is a slippery slope kind of a situation, and I don't know that there is a bright line that can be drawn other than the time that the case is scheduled to be called is the time that should be the bright line. And it is the bright line for airlines. It is the bright line for theaters. It is the bright line for the rest of society. It's the bright line for schools.
It's not the bright line for airplanes, and it's not the bright line for theaters.
If you would just say that there would have to be an explanation of reasonable, you know, a reasonable judge, and I think the examples that the Chief Justice is pointing out show some of the difficulties, 1 minute, 2 minutes, but obviously there would be a line drawn if it's 30 or 40 or 50 minutes. Is that something the judge should and must lay out before he imposes a sanction? A definition? Or does he just say it's not reasonable in my court for someone to be 2 minutes late? So you have this discrepancy where in Milwaukee, it's an accepted fact you can be 5 minutes late. Up in Washira County, where I presided for 13 years, you might say, well, he won't do anything until it's 20 minutes. You see the difficulty and the lack of even treatment that could be, let's say, imposed if we don't have that question at least resolved?
Yes, and I mean, my experience certainly is that in appearing before a wide range of judges, you have a wide range of judicial attitudes towards timeliness. And there are judges that if you are literally 1 second late, they are into the case. They have the witness up on the witness stand, and they're just simply going to go forward. Now, you can't necessarily do that in a criminal case, but there are judges that will sanction you if you're even 15 seconds late. As soon as that minute hand slips over to 1 minute after, they're going to sanction you. There are other judges that you can show up 20 minutes late and they won't say anything to you.
I'd like to put an analytical framework on these two separate sort of powers you've identified under inherent powers. One is the power to regulate or discipline that I heard you describe, and the other was sort of the controlling and handling of the calendar and the efficient handling of the calendar. And it seems to me that if we're looking at whether or not a particular sanction is appropriate, the test may be different for one versus the other. It seems to me that if you're arguing that a judge ought to be able to fine somebody or assess someone costs for 1 minute late, you're really arguing that that's the discipline, sort of, my orders mean my orders, and you're going to get fined, and you're not looking at whether or not it interfered with the calendar, because I don't think anybody can realistically argue that 1 minute one way or another is going to make a difference. Whereas if we're looking at this being an inherent power to help the judge enforce orders and make sure the court's running efficiently, that jury trials run on time, then it seems to me that we need to look at a broader picture of what are the circumstances of this particular this order, and whether or not there's an impact, and whether it's reasonable that 8 minutes late is going to impact on the efficiency of the court. Is that a right way of looking at what you're arguing?
Actually, I think that the two are somewhat interrelated here, because in this case, the judge is trying to compel attendance in a very timely fashion in order that he can control his calendar. And in this case, he's trying to, what he tries to do, and what he meant when he said in the record, I'm trying to do two cases today, if he can start the case promptly at 8:30, a lot of these misdemeanor cases are 2, 3, 4 short witnesses. He can get it over, and he can start the second case at maybe 3:30, bring
so
in a panel. And
is
so,
your argument more that what Judge Crawford, by virtue of this record, is doing, is setting, deterrence isn't the right word, but it is in part sort of setting the culture in terms of if you're going to be late, there's going to be consequences, as opposed to there being interference with his ability to try this case on this date?
No, I think it really is an interrelationship. I mean,
where is the showing that it made the 8 minutes made any difference whatsoever in this date?
His goal, as stated on the record, is to try and get through the first case so that he can impanel a case at 3:30 in the afternoon, a second case. And to the extent that he's not able to start at 8:30, it reduces the chances of him being able to impanel a second jury later in the afternoon.
Counsel, was that on the record? He says, I start my jury trials at 8:30. It's important for me. I'm going to try two cases today. There's nothing that says he's going to try another one at 3:30, or don't I have the full record?
No, you have the full record. I'm just explaining to the court what he means when he said, I'm going to try a second case, or I want to try a second case this afternoon.
Counsel, what if, looking at this record that was in the appendix, right after the judge fined him, the attorney Anderson said, oh, by the way, we're going to enter a plea, and the plea takes 7 minutes to enter. What harm was there in attorney Anderson being 8 minutes late, or 2 minutes late? Let's say he was 2 minutes late. What harm was there in him being 8 minutes late or 2 minutes late? What unreasonable curtailment of the court powers was there? What impairment of the court efficiency was there?
Well, with respect to that case, there probably wouldn't be any.
So maybe with respect to this case, there shouldn't be any fine.
Well, no, because it's not the fact that the defendant immediately pled guilty, number one. And number two, had the defendant pled guilty, there would have been probably other cases set for 8:30, so that if one falls through...
Let's say they all fell. You know, but my problem is this. You're, I think, arguing that if an attorney is 1 minute late, regardless of the effect that it may have, that a judge can impose a sanction. Is that what your argument is?
I think, yes, I think a judge would be justified in imposing sanctions for 1 minute late because the judge is trying to, as Justice Geske said, establish a culture in which lawyers show up on time. There has to be a bright line somewhere, and it doesn't make sense, I don't think, to say everybody gets a 10-minute grace period or a 20-minute grace period before I'm going to be
well,
in a sanction mode.
You use this inherent authority because the judge wants to establish a culture. So anyone that comes 1 minute late can be fined because that's not the culture that the judge wants to impose. Anyone that isn't dressed in a nice three-piece, any male that's not dressed in a nice three-piece suit, perhaps could be fined if the judge wants, under inherent powers, I'm not talking about statutory, inherent powers, because the judge wants to establish a culture that everyone dresses exceedingly well to show due deference and respect in the courtroom. I mean, where are the safeguards?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that there's a nexus between wearing a three-piece suit and...
Well, in the judge's mind is there a nexus between being 30 seconds late and anything?
Well, with respect to wearing the three-piece suit, in my opinion, it would probably be an abuse of discretion for a judge to say you have to wear a three-piece
suit. And if someone were 5 seconds late, in your opinion, would it be an abuse of discretion? Then we're just talking about a matter of time. You understand that when I ask the question.
Right. But the point of establishing a bright line in terms of timeliness is so that you don't lose control of your calendar. And when you've got hundreds of cases, thousands of cases a year, you start saying, well, you have a one-minute time grace period, then it becomes 5 minutes, and if every case on your calendar gets that weight, you do tend to lose control, or at least not running your court as efficiently as you would for a judge who's insistent.
Mr. Cannon, let me ask you a practical problem, having been part of this culture in Milwaukee. What if all 11 misdemeanor judges enforce their orders, that everybody has to be in court day 30? I mean, as a practical matter, we know that those lawyers that are in those courts have to be in multiple courts on any given day. And so they're going to be late somewhere because they can't be in all the courts. And the response to the judge, when the judge says, why weren't you here in 8:30, the lawyer says, because I had a case in another court. And the judge says, you had this scheduled at 8:30. I told you 8:30. I'm going to exercise my inherent power because I'm unable to proceed with my jury trial. What about that problem? I mean, that's one of my concerns here, is that we're going to have maybe not 11 judges doing it, but the other judges who are trying to be reasonable with their calendars and give some leeway are going to be the ones that get the lawyers last. And so I'm concerned with the effect of what you're requesting.
Well, I think that if a lawyer says, I'm late, Judge Crawford, because I was tied up in, you know, Judge Brennan's court and Judge Brennan wouldn't let me go, that's a reasonable...
Well, the question is, what time did you have to be in Judge Brennan's court? And the answer is 8:30. And Judge Crawford said, well, you should have chosen this court first because I'm ready to try this case. And I told you 8:30, and you agreed in the scheduling order to 8:30. You'd say it's an erroneous exercise of discretion to then fine that person for showing up 10 minutes or 15 or 20 minutes late?
Well, I think if your jury trial is scheduled for Judge Crawford and say you have a scheduling conference in front of Judge Brennan at 8:30, and you know that your case...
Judge Brennan's going to say, I do my scheduling conferences first. I want to get those out of the way to get into my jury trial, and so I want you here first so I can get into my jury trial. I mean, that's a practical implication of what you're arguing here, that if courts are finding people in, not in contempt, but assessing them costs, that the lawyers won't know where to go first, or they simply cannot schedule more than one case at a time, which I don't think is a reasonable option.
Right. And there has to be some reasonable accommodation when there's a conflict.
What's the standard? What's the standard you're asking for then?
Well, I think it's reasonableness or abuse of discretion, which the law requires for imposition of sanctions.
Mr. Cannon, let me, if I might, take you down a different path. In your brief, you don't rely just on the inherent power. You also utilize the statutory scheme. You refer to 805.03. You're looking at 802.10 parent 7 and 804.12. I've got some concerns in terms of the implications if we don't go along with what you're advocating. In other words, if we basically abrogate the meaning of those statutory sections, do you see any adverse problems if we don't utilize those sections?
No, I don't.
In other words, if we were to say to you those sections aren't applicable in this kind of a situation, would we cause problems for the future for judges?
Yes, I think that... I think you'd be restricting the flexibility of trial judges if the court said that judges can't use the general sanctions statutes, and there are two, one for violation of a scheduling order and one for just failure to comply with any court order. The thing about the statutory sanctions is that they're very broadly phrased, and they say the judge shall make such orders as are just. And they do give some specific examples, and would be applicable to civil cases. But I think that judges need flexibility in fashioning a sanction order tailored to the specific needs of the specific case. So, the court could choose the inherent power, or the court could choose the sanctions statutes, or the court could choose both. But I would find it disturbing if the court would say statutory sanctions don't apply here.
Let me ask you one more question, if I might. It's my understanding that you indicated that the scheduling order that was used in this case is pretty standard for misdemeanor judges in Milwaukee County. Is it also pretty standard for misdemeanor judges in Milwaukee County to impose sanctions when people are late?
It depends on the judge. There are judges who won't do it, or won't do it certainly for 8 minutes, but there are judges who will.
Counsel, you've said it would be disturbing for the court to say statutory sanctions don't apply here. What is disturbing about the court saying, look, we have 805.03, general sanctions statute, 802.10 sub 7 for scheduling orders, and they all are good, they all are valid, obviously, but when it comes to a tardy attorney, we have spoken in Gower, a tardy attorney is subject to the non-summary contempt procedures. I'm saying, dealing with this case not as a general sanctions, not as a under 805.03, not as general inherent power sanctions, but specifically as late attorney issue. What's wrong with that?
Are you saying that? Asking hypothetically?
Like the Court of Appeals essentially did.
Okay. In my opinion, it's totally unworkable to have appoint a special prosecutor, have that prosecutor issue a formal complaint, probably have a second judge brought in to hear an independent hearing for a lawyer who's 8 minutes late. That's time-consuming, it's very expensive, and it's totally impractical, in my opinion, and I don't think most judges are going to use that kind of cumbersome procedure if that's what they're required to do.
And that accused person would certainly be entitled to a jury trial on the issue.
Yes, it could very well be in a contempt situation, because then you're facing possible incarceration and substantial fines. And this court has said contempt is a draconian measure. It should be used sparingly. And I think Judge Crawford was exactly correct in not using the contempt procedure.
And I can envision with that procedure that was suggested, the judge who was offended by the actions of the lawyer would also be the prime witness, so close his court, while he goes and acts as a witness in the other court, if he could ever get a district attorney to issue the charge.
Well, you probably have to appoint special counsel or special prosecutor.
Justice Babbage has a question for you. He's been very patient.
Justice Babbage just asked one of them that I was going to ask, but let me ask you this. Under the inherent power, what is the check that society has on the judge who abuses that power? Well, is it a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals?
Yes, it's the abuse of discretion standard which the appellate court can invoke.
So the lawyer that has been accused of this has a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals, and the standard is abuse of discretion.
Yes.
And the Court of Appeals only then has the record upon which to make that decision, because there's not a second trial, correct?
In this particular case, yes.
Now, so in this case, is this record sufficient for the Court of Appeals to make it, where the judge simply says, I'm inconvenienced?
Yes, he's not just saying he's inconvenienced. He's saying that there is a violation of a scheduling order which required you to be here at 8:30, and you showed up at 8:38.
Mr. Cannon, you strike me as being a very thoughtful person. What if you were writing this decision, what would you say to the trial judges in this situation as to what they should put on the record so that there is a review-worthy appeal for the Court of Appeals to consider?
Well, I think that you have to look at what the purpose is in imposing sanctions. And in this case, the purpose is to compel compliance with the pretrial scheduling order. And the violation of that order, like violating the citation of a non-published decision, requires imposition of sanctions. You could go beyond that, and maybe this isn't, I would concede, this isn't the greatest record in terms of making findings about interference with the efficiency of the court, although there are some things that are just common sense, and we have supplied a number of statistics in the reply brief that would allow this court, I think, to conclude that lawyers showing up late are going to have a material impairment on the efficiency of a busy misdemeanor court.
What if there is a legitimate excuse that is put on the record, i.e., I had to be in Judge Brennan's court? Would that then, do you think, be an abuse of discretion for Judge Crawford to have proceeded?
I think so. But although I guess I'd want to maybe ask why he was in Judge Brennan's court, for what purpose. But, I mean, judges have a responsibility to try and accommodate the needs of the system.
So maybe what you're saying is that the record should contain, at the very least, an opportunity for the defense, for the attorney, to explain, to give adequate explanations, as well as a warning to the attorney that maybe it's not going to be just enough to say I didn't have a legitimate excuse. You better tell me why, because if the elevators weren't working, that might be the case.
Well, that's the why a trial judge has to give the offending lawyer the opportunity of allocution to explain why he's late. And you may hear a good reason or a good excuse, in which case you don't sanction the lawyer, or it may be, as in this case, I have no reasonable excuse, Judge.
Well, I've sat in Milwaukee misdemeanor court. Cases are called, and lawyers were there 10 minutes or 15 minutes or an hour before are out at the moment the case is called, another case is called. Apparently, all the cases are scheduled for 8:30. Right?
That's correct.
So suppose the judge says, okay, I've got 15 lawyers that are supposed to appear at 8:30. I want them all to stand up, and 10 don't. Can you find them?
Find them for what?
Not being there. Your scheduling order was to come at 8:30. Well, the instructions were to come at 8:30. They're not there.
I think that is a violation of the court order and scheduling order, and if the lawyers do eventually show up and they don't have an excuse why they weren't there at 8:30, I think that they're subject to sanctions. There was a...
The excuse is that, Judge, I know you scheduled 40 cases for 8:30. Maybe 40 is high, but I'm told that judges in misdemeanor court can do 30, 40, 50 cases a day. Suppose they say, okay, and I know that there are others, and I figure that somebody's going to be there, and you could have proceeded, and the judge did proceed, because there were 5 or 10 out of those. The others were in other misdemeanor courts. That includes the DAs, the assistant DAs, and defense counsel.
If the defense lawyer was in another court, I think that's a reasonable excuse.
I took my kid to child care. It took me an extra 10 minutes, but I knew it wouldn't bother you because you have 40 other cases.
I don't know. I think that if you're tied up in traffic or if something came up at the last minute, I've been on both sides of that. I've seen judges say...
I know. Yeah. I mean, obviously, attorneys are on both sides. Okay. Use of discretion is a tough standard.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. case as it's important to trial judges, not only in Milwaukee County, but across the state, is important to defense attorneys, criminal defense attorneys who work, as I do, on a daily basis, not only in misdemeanor courts, but the felony courts of Milwaukee County and throughout the state. And as a practical matter, I'm not asking the court to fashion a rule designed to assist Milwaukee County attorneys, but to fashion a rule that is just on how judges can handle attorneys who are late. And attorneys shouldn't be late. I mean, I acknowledge that. They shouldn't be late. As a practical matter, in Milwaukee County, I have set perhaps 3 or 4 cases, misdemeanor cases, at 8:30, as they all are scheduled. I may have a felony motion in the safety building, which is a 5-minute walk away, also at 8:30.
Counsel, you didn't say any of that at trial.
I'm talking about the practicality of demanding promptness on a trial date without an explanation as to whether 8 minutes late or 30 seconds late or a half hour late disrupts that judge's calendar.
So you
know that I am asking the court, the limits that I'm asking the court to put on inherent authority, which I acknowledge a judge has inherent authority to control his or her corporal, to make sure that the dignity of that court is maintained, that proper decorum, that judge sitting there can transact their business. That judge has the inherent authority to do that.
So if you would have, in this case, the judge had 2 jury trials, this was the jury trial that you apparently knew that this was a jury trial, I take it from the record. If what you're asking this court to fashion is a rule, basically as suggested by your opponent, that you'd have the right of elocution and the judge would explain what was going on in this particular instance, that he, as he did a little bit here, but not enough. Is that what you're saying? In other words, you're not arguing about inherent power. What you're saying is that the judge should have some reasonable rules and that you should be given a right to explain why you were late. Is that what...
I'm asking the court to go beyond that, to, while I, as an attorney who was late, have an obligation, I have an opportunity, I have a right to be heard under due process to explain where I was, why I'm late. But the judge, under due process, if he or she wants to use their inherent authority, that means to control the courtroom, that somehow you've disrupted that calendar, that judge, if the judge is going under inherent authority, not only does that judge have to follow the Constitution...
Counsel, I'm sorry. Would you stand in front of the microphone because you're being recorded?
Right.
I apologize for interrupting you.
The judge has to follow the mandates of the Constitution and also the statutes. So not only does the attorney who is late in this case have to have a reasonable opportunity to be heard, but also... if the judge is relying on inherent authority, that judge is obligated, when using that power, which is a very powerful thing, and it should be, as the cases indicate, used with discretion. Because it is so powerful, it should be used in very limited situations. The judge should be obligated, because that is inherent, it is so powerful, that judge should be obligated to put on the record how 8 minutes or 1 minute or 30 seconds or 80 minutes disrupts the day. This is a standard scheduling order used by not all of the misdemeanor courts. Some of them use it. Attorneys routinely sign it as they're required.
Does that make it less enforceable because it's a standard scheduling order? Should there be a special one? Or what do you have in mind as far as the type of scheduling order that should be used?
The point is that there is one judge that fines attorneys for being late. One misdemeanor judge. No matter what the lateness is, whether it's a minute or beyond. We have in Milwaukee County a system where we have a form scheduling order used by some judges that lines 7 and 8, sanctions and timeliness, are not enforced. Attorneys are obligated to be on time, but judges as well are obligated. If they are relying on inherent authority, they're obligated to use it sparingly and to use it justly. And this is a situation where it was not used justly.
Mr. Anderson, tell me, if Judge Crawford had called over the jury panel, called the jury room at 8 o'clock and said, I've got a jury trial set at 8:30 and I would like the panel ready, and I want them lined up and I want them brought up so that they arrive exactly at 8:30 at my door, and you were 8 minutes late, and he put on the record that he had done all that and that the jurors had been standing out in the hall with all the hubbub of the misdemeanor courts and waiting to come into the courtroom until you arrived and disrupted the proceeding that way, then would have what he did been appropriate? Does it meet the test that you're setting up?
Yes. It does, because there is a jury panel waiting in the hall at 8:30. There are actual veneer people there waiting. Resources, a bailiff to bring them up, the jury is there, the court is waiting. I'm not there. I then have cost that court, cost the county money. And then the judge would be obligated to put on the record why inherent authority is necessary here to impose a sanction, because there is a cost involved.
Well, let me ask you the alternative. What if he had not sanctioned you at the time, but noted that you had arrived, you know, 8 minutes late and you had no explanation, and at the end of the day, 5 o'clock came around, it was the next jury trial and everything had been running efficiently, and he had to go over, he had to go over 10 minutes, as a result pay some overtime to his court clerk. Could he then at that point go back and sanction the lawyer who was late in the morning based on that, putting all that on the record?
No, it has to be on the record in a hearing forum.
Yeah, but couldn't he call you back at that point? At the time of sentencing of your case, say you were 8 minutes late, and as a result, I went 10 minutes over at the end of the day. And as a result, the county, everybody had to stay here on this other case, and I had to pay some. We had to pay some overtime to my clerk. I'm just trying to see where the limits are, whether the interference has to be occurring at the time of the lateness, or whether the judge might later on be able to show the impact on the calendar for the day.
I acknowledge the difficulty and the cumbersomeness of that method. If you follow my argument, that would be a logical conclusion.
The reason I'm asking that question is that, in part, that's what the judge is trying to prevent in the morning. Even though the jurors may not be in the hall, it may set back things that happen all day long. And there's no way for the judge to put on the record at that point what the impact is, except that knowledge and experience tells you when you start later, it's going to have an impact. It may have an impact that ripples through the day. And I think that petitioner's point is that just to say a time means a time, and that's the only way you can ensure that courts are going to run in a timely way, that you shouldn't have to show specifically the impact because you don't know what it might be on a given day.
It's a ruse here to say that I start my trials at 8:30. No trial starts at 8:30. If the example is that if I come in 8 minutes late, we wait for a jury to come up. We could wait an hour, we could wait 2 hours. At the end of the day, the judge says, Mr. Anderson, we're going to start up. Counsel, we're going to be starting up promptly at 8:30 the next day. I come in 8 minutes late, then I am in direct violation of a court order, knowing that there is a jury waiting.
Mr. Anderson, let me ask you a very practical question. You got the chance here, the judge gave you the chance to explain why you were late, and you indicated you had no explanation. Why? Why didn't you give some type of explanation?
Judge, the situation is that I am there. I knew that the potential for me to try a case that morning, this possession of marijuana case, was high. I'm sitting there with my client in front of the trial judge, the judge that has to rule on motions in limine, my arguments, rule on positions that I take on that case. He then, with my client sitting there, I am there to try a case.
8 minutes late.
Exactly. I come in 8 minutes late. I acknowledged that I was late. But I'm sitting there with my client to try a case that is going to start at some point. He asks me, why were you late? That is not a reasonable opportunity to be heard. He asked me, with my client, knowing that in an hour there's going to be a jury there and I'm going to have to try the case, he wants me to sit and banter with him.
Well, all you had to say is, I'm sorry, Judge, I'm 8 minutes late. I apologize to the court. It's my fault. I apologize to the court.
That is the problem here, is there is one particular judge who rules the courtroom like a despot, as the Court of Appeals indicated, that it's despotism, that it's somebody standing alone ruling a court with an iron fist and wants you to explain where you were in front of your client.
I'm trying to get your point. Are you saying that you did not want to engage in a colloquy lest it become, with this particular judge, not an embarrassment, but the judge might think you're challenging his authority and you might thereby alienate the judge, which would affect your client? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. That is not the reasonable opportunity to be heard that the law demands.
If you got a despot judge, why in the world, in good judgment, don't you go to his courtroom first? You practice there enough, you know who these judges are and what their traits of controlling their courtroom are. It would show very poor judgment if you were in another court on that day. We can't tell because you didn't tell the judge where you were.
Yeah, the theory is despotism rules.
Well, the Republic says so.
As a lawyer with numerous appearances, I have to make choices. I have to tell other courts where I'm going to be and to handle matters that I believe need to be handled first and then go on to a case.
Does the record here show that you called the judge's chambers and said I'm going to be late for what reason?
The record is the record that's before the court.
Because as a trial judge, when I had a lawyer tell me that, I would then call the other judge, and we got to work out our own arrangements. All right, you can have it for 15 minutes, but then I want it, because I got a jury sitting here. But these things, you didn't even notify the judge that you were going to be late, did you? You don't have to answer. That's not a part of the record.
But it isn't part of the record, but no, I didn't. But the standard practice, Judge Crawford could have called me up to the bench and said, listen, you're 8 minutes late. I start at 8:30. I don't want you to be late again.
He doesn't have to,
but...
And you as a lawyer had a responsibility to be there at 8:30, and whether the judge is despotic or not, Mr. Anderson, that was your responsibility, wasn't it?
Yes, and I acknowledge that. But
do you think that the judge should have fined you outside the presence of your client and after the case was over?
No.
Okay. You don't think the judge should have fined you in the presence of your client and before the case begins? You don't think he should fine you after the case is over? What about lunchtime?
The judge, before he has a right, if he's claiming inherent authority, or if he's claiming now that he's using the civil sanction statutes, then the judge has a duty to explain how 8 minutes impaired his authority, other than that he wants to start at 8:30.
Well, okay, I'm a little bit confused now, counsel. I'm getting less confused about how things operate in the Milwaukee Misdemeanor Court. But you now seem to be saying, in response to the chief's question, that your gripe here is not with the judge's, not with the legal proposition that a judge has inherent authority to do this, but the gripe is that he didn't do it right. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that with inherent authority comes that is limited by the Constitution, which is due process, and that he did not follow due process.
Well, what is due process here, that he starts a non-summary contempt proceeding against you? What is your light of due process?
That there is a reasonable opportunity to be heard, and that this 8 minutes proved disruptive to the court.
Counsel, what are you saying? Are you saying that in these circumstances he must proceed in a non-summary procedure? Or are you saying he can do this, he just didn't do it right? He didn't put enough on the record.
Gower, the non-summary contempt statutes would govern here.
Okay,
and
so
those put in place the due process rights that an attorney who's late would have.
But didn't you say to me before that if the jury had been waiting outside the door, that if he had put on the record the jurors, that the veneer panel has been standing out there for 8 minutes waiting, and that he could have done what he did here if he put that on the record?
If he is relying on his inherent authority, it is still limited by due process, which gives the authority.
Just let me know, yes or no. Can he do it without using Gower and non-summary contempt? Can he say, I was ready to start the trial, the prospective jurors were waiting outside the door. Mr. Anderson, you are responsible for slowing this up, and the court proceedings have been impeded because you were late, and as a result, I'm going to fine you $50. Could he have done that?
No.
Does that mean he
no.
does not? Okay.
Well, counsel, isn't that the very thing that you conceded in the trial court and are arguing, I thought, again here in the Supreme Court? Page 5 of the Court of Appeals opinion. The Court of Appeals judge says, I'm not going to accept your concession. You are conceding, I think it's page 5, you are conceding that there is inherent authority to sanction outside of 785, and the Court of Appeals judge says, I'm not accepting that. Your argument was there's inherent authority as long as it is doesn't unreasonably curtail the court's powers, materially impair court efficiency. Those two elements, rather, are what limits the inherent authority. That was your argument.
Yes.
That was your concession.
Yes.
Now you seem to be saying something different. Let me ask it this way. Is there inherent authority to sanction an attorney who is tardy outside of Chapter 785?
That is the point that I do concede. If a judge says that he is not finding an attorney in contempt, but that he is sanctioning the attorney.
But that would be under 80503 then?
I ask for inherent authority.
Under inherent authority, there are still due process limits which demand of a judge two things. One, the opportunity to be heard. You can't take away that even under inherent authority. You still have to act within the Constitution, which means due process, a reasonable opportunity to be heard, and also inherent authority. It is so limited.
Counsel.
That it, you, yes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish. So we'll limit that.
If it impairs a court's power, if it impairs a court's authority, that it disrupts a court, then inherent authority kicks in, but still within those due process limits. You can't, because a jury is waiting there at 8:30, I come in at 8:38, you cannot say, I've had this jury waiting, therefore I fine you $50, without an opportunity for that person to be heard, a reasonable opportunity.
With all due respect, seems to me that if you look at these cases, and you look at the Court of Appeals, I agree they're not beyond doubt. There's an agreement here that a circuit court has inherent power to protect its proceedings and ensure that its orders are obeyed. There's also in the cases that if this is contempt, the legislature has set forth a procedure for the court's inherent power to exercise in contempt, either civil contempt or, well, I guess they don't call it that way, within the court and outside the court. Your response to these questions of Justice Geske and Justice Babbage and Justice Bradley confuse me. Because you say that there has to be inherent, that there is inherent power, which, as I've explained the cases, if I've explained them correctly, is there. Then in response to the question, do you have to go under 784, you waffle. But then you say you need due process. Well, the whole point of 784 is to give you a due process, namely a procedure for a hearing. So I think when they're asking you these questions, they're saying to you, can you, in effect, hold someone in contempt? You don't call it contempt, but it is contempt, not following 784. That's another way of stating their questions.
No, if you're holding someone in contempt,
now the judge says, I'm not holding you in contempt, but I'm going to fine you anyway because you have disobeyed a court order. Now, okay? So we're not under contempt. Do you still have to follow 784? Or do you have to follow a procedure like 784? Is that what you're arguing?
Yes. So 784, the contempt statute, is the due process protections.
So you're saying even though the judge doesn't say it's contempt, it's got to follow 784 procedures because that's due process as constitutionally required. Is that your argument?
Yes, the due inherent authority does not come without restrictions.
So the process that is due is outlined in your answer now in 784.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Now, then the follow-up question that I have to that is that all the information I have, given the crowded calendars of the district attorneys and the judges and everybody else, makes that following that procedure a practical nullity, that because of the practicalities confronting the district attorney's office and the judge having to appoint somebody, that in effect, it will never happen. That a judge will not be able, a judge, no matter how reasonable, will not be able to exercise his inherent authority to keep control of the calendar because if he does what you're saying, it'll never happen. That's what I hear. Now, am I hearing wrong?
You are not. That is why it is used and so sparingly, and why the law indicates that it should be used sparingly, that it described as a draconian method.
How can a court maintain its calendar? How can a court require attendance by counsel on time or relatively within time limits in order to run an orderly calendar?
In practical terms, a judge could call you up to the bench and say, listen, Mr. Anderson, if this happens again, I'm going to find you in contempt. An attorney...
But that judge cannot find the lawyer in contempt for being late, right? The judge has to follow a non-summary procedure and appoint a special prosecutor and have a complaint filed against that and assigned to another judge, and this judge becomes a witness. I mean, isn't that the practical implications of what you're arguing? The judge cannot find you in contempt under Garrett.
Practical implications are that a judge does have the authority under the statute, whether he's going under or inherent authority or he's following the 785 statute, you still must have a reasonable opportunity to be heard.
So that judge can do nothing other than appoint a special prosecutor in order to enforce the court orders. Is that your position? And a tardy lawyer. That's the only option is to...
a disruption. There's a jury. We start our trial. I'm to be back at 1:30. There's a jury in the box. I come in at 2 o'clock.
The judge says to you, you're half an hour late. The jury's been here in the box. Where have you been? And you say, I have no reasonable explanation. You're in front of your client. Same kind of scenario. Can the judge find you?
Not without a hearing. Separate hearing, but it's not...
Why can't the judge then just say the case is dismissed? You haven't prosecuted.
He'd like that.
Yeah, okay. Well, not against you. You can say that you defaulted. You defaulted. Your client is found guilty.
It's impractical to rely on the civil procedure statutes as sanctioning in a criminal matter. Though all of those statutes, as I indicated in my brief, show that there is actual financial harm or disruption, whether it's...
Mr. Anderson, I'm still having a hard time figuring out where your position is. I guess I'd like you to follow through on my example of... You started the example. You're half an hour late. You're in the middle of the jury trial. The jurors are there. The judge says, where have you been? You say, I don't have an explanation. And then what's the judge supposed to do? Assuming the judge thinks that you ought to be assessed in costs for that half hour.
The judge can say we will deal with this matter at the conclusion of the day when the jury is gone.
Okay, so the jury's gone. We're at the end of the day. Your client's still there, I assume. Both lawyers are there. What does the judge do?
Judge then can ask me where I've been.
And you say I don't have any reasonable explanation. I was late. Just like the answer that you gave here. Then what? Judge can do what?
The judge would then make a record as to why this was disruptive,
The judge will say the jury was waiting, we were waiting, everybody was here, the witnesses were here, we couldn't proceed, we're late.
And find me.
And then the judge can find me.
And you're not entitled to a 784 proceeding.
I am entitled to a hearing with a reasonable opportunity to be heard.
What does that mean, Mr. Anderson, a reasonable opportunity to be heard?
That means, as in the Hawaii case cited by both parties, a right to present a defense, a right to present argument, not an on-the-spot, where were you, and then a fine. It's a separate hearing with the right to counsel, with the right to prepare a defense, and a right to be heard. It's not an on-the-spot.
I thought you were explaining to Justice Geske, this is at the end of the day, so now you've gone, you're going to have a right to counsel, so you've got to contact a lawyer, and that lawyer will come in and represent you. Is that what you're suggesting as a procedure?
Yes, you have a right to defend yourself.
Oh, what about the constitution of a judge?
I missed the first part, Justice.
I said, now we're going to have a hearing. You have a right to counsel. What judge is going to hear it? The same judge that has already fined you or is angry at you for holding up the proceeding for a half hour? Aren't you going to ask for a substitution of judge?
I may.
Oh, but you have the right to. Is that your position?
Aren't you a little late by that time?
You're too late as to the trial judge, yes.
Oh, the trial is over under Justice Geske's scenario, but now you've asked that there be a separate little hearing, and you want a right to counsel, and you want a right to make a statement. Don't you want a judge that hasn't already set forth the proceeding or the result?
I would.
Okay. Not an easy case, Mr. Anderson. Thank you. All right. Mr. Cannon, you have a few moments in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to make a couple of quick points. Number one, I don't think that there's any practical difference as to whether the juror pool is in the jury assembly room or they're outside the courtroom in the hallway. The trial can't get started until Mr. Anderson shows up. And even if they were in the jury assembly room, and let's say it took 15 minutes to get them up there, judge is probably going to be meeting to talk about motions in limine, talking about jury instructions. There's a lot of things that can go on, but nothing can go on until the lawyers are present in the court.
Mr. Cannon, the barn door, the horse is already gone because the lawyer is late. What's the matter with, this is a tough case, as I think you can concede, and the difficulty of the contempt, yet the difficulty of the judge. Maybe the judge should just refer this to BAPR, the Board of Attorney Professional Responsibility. If the lawyer is unhappy with the judge and thinks the judge is despotic, lawyers should refer to the Judicial Commission. Maybe that's the place for all of this.
I would disagree respectfully. I think that to refer a matter of this nature to BAPR would be a gross overreaction. And if the judge acted despotically, I suppose you always have the right to file a complaint with the Judicial Commission. But there's nothing in the record that would support a characterization that Judge Crawford acted despotically.
Suppose it was $250.
For 8 minutes? In my opinion, I think that would probably be... I wouldn't certainly impose a fine of $250 for 8 minutes late. Whether that is beyond the... is an abuse of the judge's discretion, I think reasonable people could differ on that.
If reasonable people differ, then the judge is affirmed.
That's correct.
What about $500?
I think probably most reasonable people would not agree that $500 would be...
So if the judge keeps it low enough, he can keep doing this to lawyers because no one's going to put the money into an appeal. No lawyer would. And so anything under $500, you think, in effect, the lawyer is stuck and doesn't have an appeal because it will be affirmed.
No, I think a lawyer always has the right to...
Oh, so you've got a right to appeal. The question is whether you're going to win.
I think if the judge doesn't abuse his discretion, he has the right to, or she has the right to impose sanctions for violation of a scheduling order.
Would you agree that when the judge does this, at the very minimum, the judge must indicate why this was disruptive to him, this particular case, and this particular tardiness was disruptive?
No. I think a judge can say, there's a scheduling order in effect. You were ordered to be here at 8:30.
But, Mr. Cannon, come on, you've heard all... We all know, we all know now how it works in Milwaukee. These misdemeanor judges will put 20 cases on at 8:30. if it doesn't disrupt, if Mr. Anderson appears 8 minutes late, but the fact that he hasn't disrupted anything in my court, are you saying that the judge, just because he doesn't like him, can fine him without saying anything on the record as to why this 8 minutes is deserving of a fine?
Well, he isn't being fined because the judge doesn't like him. He's being fined for violating a scheduling order and causing the court to start at least 8 minutes late on a day when the court is trying to complete.
We don't know that. We don't know that from this record. We don't know that the judge was ready to start with this. The judge, I mean, from all I know, the judge might have had six other cases scheduled for 8:30 that morning, and he singled out Mr. Anderson.
Well, it is true. It is not in the record.
My inclination is to go with you, but I need something in the record that a court of appeals can look at to determine whether or not the judge was being fair. I read this record, and I have no indication that Judge Crawford was fair. He says, I start my cases at 8:30. Well, he might have had 30 cases scheduled at 8:30. What is there in this record to indicate to a reviewing court that he was not being despotic, that he was not singling out Mr. Anderson?
Well, in Mr. Anderson's case is the case that was tried that morning, and...
Do we know that from this record? Does a reviewing court know that from this record?
I believe that the... I believe that the transcript here is just of the colloquy between the trial court and Mr. Anderson. But the case did... in fact, it's in Mr. Anderson's brief. The case was tried on November 5th, that morning.
What time?
Pardon?
What time?
Immediately upon the conclusion of the transcript, the colloquy between the court and Mr. Anderson, the court, the trial commenced.
I have two. Is your... I'm not totally clear with your position. Is your position with regard to the scheduling order that if there is a violation of a scheduling order, regardless if it has any detrimental effect, there can be a $50 sanction? Or is your position that if there is a violation of a scheduling order and if there is some detrimental effect, then there is no erroneous exercise of discretion in imposing the sanction?
It would be the former.
So, regardless of detrimental effect, it's a per se rule. 30 seconds late, regardless of effect, a sanction can be imposed.
Yes, the statute says violations of scheduling orders go to sanctions. The scheduling order itself says violation and you must be on time, and there's no requirement in the case law, no requirement in the statute that you must make a finding of impaired efficiency or adverse effect on the court's trial calendar.
Just one sentence.
I would reject the characterization that Judge Crawford acted in any way despotically or contrary to due process. The Latham case requires only notice and a hearing. He had the notice in the scheduling order and in the statutes. He had hearing, a right of allocution. He offered no reasonable excuse. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cannon. That ends our argument in Anderson versus Circuit Court for Milwaukee County. The court will take a few moments break so that the students...